A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We are watching what's going on with the markup in the House Rules Committee as of, 11 a.m. Eastern, which is when I'm sitting down to record this. We still have not seen the manager's amendment language that may or may not include Section 2 of the Hearing Protection Act, as well as language removing short-barreled rifles and shotguns from the auspices of the NFA, or at least removing the taxes on those items. We will have an update for you on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company, but be sure to check out the website throughout the day as well. We will be keeping you up to date on the latest out of the House Rules Committee. And of course, you know, there is the potential for further revisions, not on the House floor, but when this big, beautiful bill, in the words of Donald Trump, makes it over to the Senate, there'll be some continued negotiations, I suspect, on a number of issues, and that could include language regarding suppressors and short-barreled firearms as well. Now, as I mentioned on yesterday's program, I had the opportunity to sit down yesterday morning, shortly before I talked with Representative Andrew Clyde, for Tuesday's Cam and Company, with Cody Wisniewski, who is the CEO and of the FPC Action Foundation. And we were specifically talking about one of the cases that FPC has taking on gun-free zones in the Lone Star State of Texas. Now, there's some oddities with this case, primarily with the position taken by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who doesn't want to defend the laws in question, but also doesn't want to see FPC's lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of these laws move forward. It is a weird one, and we talked about it extensively with Cody, as well as Cody's recent op-ed of the Washington Examiner, in which he lays out the, I think, the correct argument that, listen, even if we get rid of the ATF and that agency were to disappear tomorrow, that doesn't address the underlying problems that basically are the rules and the laws that the ATF is charged with enforcing. So that's where our conversation kicked off, but we quickly turned our attention to the Ziegenfuss case. Fascinating conversation with a great guy. So take a listen to our conversation with Cody Wisniewski here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Cody, it is good to see you, my friend. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Yes, sir. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. All right. So I want to get started with this op-ed that that you wrote. This appeared in the Washington Examiner. And, you know, as we're dealing with the budget reconciliation bill, obviously, you know, there are some folks who are wondering, okay, why are we funding the ATF at all, right? Why are we not just getting rid of this agency? But as you point out, the ATF certainly has a history, right, of abuse. And there's good reason why people want to see this agency go away. But even if the ATF were to disappear tomorrow, as you say, the underlying issues are still there, right? Because we're really talking about the laws and the regulations that would continue to be in place, that would have to be enforced by some agency.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, it's important that we call for the disbandment of the ATF, but you have to dismantle the power structure, right? There is this entire unconstitutional power structure of rules, regulations, and laws that are empowering the agency. And those things, if you just erase the name ATF tomorrow, those things remain. And that has to be a target. That has to be a focus. I mean, if you look at ATF right now, right, ATF is housed within Department of Justice, right? So they answer Department of Justice. The ATF's budget, just the ATF, is like $1.8 billion. Department of Justice's budget is $44 billion. Now, that encompasses a lot of different agencies, but if you just got rid of the ATF tomorrow, presumably all of its law enforcement function, all of its regulatory function, all of those rules, they're not going to just disappear overnight. They're going to go somewhere. They might stay at Department of Justice. They might go, you know, in the piece I talk about it, there's been a lot of discussion about it, that they might go towards FBI, they might go towards Department of Homeland Security. But It's that unconstitutional power structure that's behind the agency that we're kind of losing in the discussion.
And to that end, I mean, we are seeing, and listen, I mean, not all of that can be undone through executive action, right? I mean, Congress has a role to play, and I think there's an argument to be made that Congress has abdicated its authority over the course of decades and has just, given way too much power to these agencies to sort of regulate themselves. But we have seen, I think, some interesting moves on the part of the Trump administration to date. First of all, the budget for the ATF, the proposed budget, I think is decreased by $600 million, going from 1.8 to about 1.2 billion, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
We've also seen things, like DOJ just recently settled this lawsuit over force reset triggers, in a way that I think gun owners are going to be very pleased with, right? How much of that do you think the Trump administration can do? I mean, we are still waiting, I think, for the formal repeal of the pistol stabilizing brace rule, the engaged in the business rule. We've been told that these things are going to happen, but to the best of my knowledge, we've not yet seen those rules, rules that would repeal those regulations published in the Federal Register. What else do you think the Trump administration could do without Congress, formally repealing the Gun Control Act or the National Firearms Act?
Yeah, I mean the administration should be looking at, or whomever is in charge of the ATF on any given Sunday should be taking a look at the rules and regulations that they have in place to see what they can fix and what they can wind back, right? Interestingly, they don't actually need to repeal the pistol brace rule because we defeated it in court. And so fortunately, right, that rule has already been struck down. As of right now, that rule is vacated. Now they appealed that decision in our mock case. And that appeal is still pending. The Fifth Circuit actually just scheduled it for argument later this year. But, we'll see what position Department of Justice takes on that case now that there's a different head of Department of Justice. That's going to be a big factor. But, there's a lot of parts of that. The framer receiver rule that was at issue in Vanderstock, right? There's a lot of bits and pieces of that too that were alleged, like we made those arguments in court at the district court, and then as the case moved up, it kind of just focused in solely on the definition of firearm, the definition of frame or receiver. But there's issues with the definition of complete weapon, there's issues with the record keeping requirements. Those were all issues in that case as well. So there's a lot of bits and pieces in the regulatory landscape that ATF can look to and Department of Justice can look to in order to kind of fix some of those issues. Sporting purposes is always something that people are, is something that has to be looked at by the administration. That's another big avenue for the administration, right? Is anything that deals with importation, anything that is on that kind of executive side is going to be a lot, would be a lot simpler for the administration to fix, given that, the executive is going to have broader authority when it comes to, when it comes to those sorts of rules, regulations, and enforcement of, or interpretation rather, maybe of various laws.
And of course, the flip side of that, unfortunately, is that what can be done via the executive branch of government can be undone, right, via the executive branch. So we're seeing this right now with a lot of the Biden rules hopefully being undone. But again, the next time we've got an anti-gun president in the White House, we can expect to see this, start all over again.
One big factor there, though, just before you jump, is one thing that you have to learn from what happens in courtrooms. You have to learn from what prior administrations and stuff does. One thing that is a big takeaway is if you look at the DACA line of cases, right, the Dreamers cases, when the first Trump administration, whatever your position on DACA or Dreamers is, it doesn't matter. The takeaway is the same. The first Trump administration, that was done in a memo by Obama. And the first Trump administration basically tried to just rescind it via a memo. It was a memo. We were going to take it back via memo. The court struck that down, said, nope, because it created a reliance interest, because, there were people in the country that had based their lives and decisions on the program, even though it was created by a memo, they had to go through a formal process to address how it would affect that reliance interest if they were going to change the policy. Well, that's a key. Like, you need to be able to learn from that going forward. So, if you change some of these rules and regulations and it creates a reliance interest, then if a subsequent administration can't just undo it with the stroke of a pen, They would have to go through a rulemaking and determine how that reliance interest is impacted. Of course, sometimes this game is a one-way ratchet, and things for the other side don't always turn out the same way as the things for us on the side of rights and liberty. But you have to be able to kind of learn those lessons and take those away and incorporate that as you move forward.
That's interesting. I mean, and it does suggest that there would be ways to expeditiously make some changes, right? That would not necessarily be expeditiously undone by a future administration. Huh.
And this is the thing that we talked about before, right? The administration, the government can bind itself. And that is hugely important. That's a tool that government doesn't like to use because it doesn't like to restrain itself. But government can bind itself to timelines. It can bind itself to processing windows. It can bind itself on all of those things, whether you're looking at, implementation of the NFA, for example, right? Those are all things where the administration or the agency or the processing agency can all bind itself to specific processes and procedures. And then if those are in place and people are using those regularly, then it's a lot more difficult to unwind that particular clock. And it's not even like it's a crazy policy. It's not like you're saying, the other side would, laughs or cringes maybe when we say, abolish the ATF, even though it's a serious policy point. But you're really just talking about like government needs to process a form within 30 days. Right, like that's not offensive. That's just a move the paper in an efficient manner kind of thing.
Well, and the other part of that though is I mean technically in California, right, you're supposed to process carry permits within I think what is it 120 days, and you've got jurisdictions that are taking 2 years, right? So I agree with you about the government binding itself, but I think there also needs to be some teeth to that. There needs to be a penalty attached if the government does not live up to its word, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they should not just, and that's a great point. They should not just bind themselves, but they need to create those penalties for themselves if they don't meet those deadlines.
Yeah.
That's the
Okay.
whole, the original background check, right? With the, you can just transfer the item if you don't hear back within a certain number of days. That was why, right? That was not designed as I've talked about this before. People will call it a loophole, right? It's this like 3-day loophole. Well, no, it's an important pressure valve on government of like, if you do not process within a certain number of days, then you lose the opportunity to process. So it incentivizes government to do something quickly and efficiently, which government doesn't ever do. And so that's the sort of thing that you can build in, right? Well, you have to process these, any NFA paperwork, any forms, you have to process within 30 days or they're automatically approved. Better get to processing.
Right, exactly. Well, I hope that the administration takes your advice on this issue. And I do want to talk about something else while we've got you here because I think this is just fascinating. So, one of the cases that FPC is involved in is a challenge to some of the gun-free zones that are in place in Texas, which generally has pretty good gun laws. But there are a couple of areas where people are not allowed to carry. And so this lawsuit that has been filed, I find this fascinating. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is defending this law or these laws, but he doesn't really want to, he says. He says that in court papers, he says, yeah, these laws probably are constitutionally suspect. But he says that FPC and the individual plaintiffs here don't have standing to sue, right? One of his arguments is that, well, you guys are suing the Director of Public Safety. The Director of Public Safety doesn't really enforce these laws. It's up to local police departments to enforce these statutes. I gotta say, Cody, it's a weird argument that yes, I think these laws are unconstitutional, but I don't think this lawsuit should move forward to challenge these laws.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy, and it's not something we would necessarily expect to come out of Texas, right? I'm
Yeah.
very the brief that Texas filed, that the AG's office filed, I'm fairly familiar with because I've seen it come out of California, I've seen it come out of New York, I've seen it come out of New Jersey. Never seen it come out of Texas. So basically, I mean their position is even a little bit stronger than that. Their position is, these laws, which to be clear are, it's a ban on complete ban on carry in any establishment that derives more than 51% or more of its proceeds from the sale of alcohol. Racetracks and their affiliated parking lots and whatnot. And then sporting events, but it includes anywhere that a sporting event is occurring. So like if there was a high school baseball game in a community park where there's, no security, there's easy access to the public, and there's like, you have to bring your family to go and watch one of your kids play baseball, you're disarmed. Like you're required to disarm in that scenario. So these are really broad, right? And those 51% establishments, it doesn't matter if you're drinking or not.
Right.
You ha cannot carry. This also includes places like if you're in Fort Worth, right? Billy Bob's is really famous. That place has gift shops, it's got restaurants, it's got a concert venue, it's got all sorts of stuff. It's not just a bar. It's a lot more than that. It's places where families go. So this encompasses a huge amount. Well, Texas is effectively saying like these laws are unconstitutional. They do not have a historical analog, and thus they're unconstitutional. But what they're saying is, court, don't even bother getting to that question because the plaintiffs don't have standing to challenge it. So they're basically saying, if the plaintiffs have standing, we lose, but we don't want you to hand us a loss, which is absolutely dumbfounding. And in doing so, the way that Texas has gone about the argument, it basically undermines gun rights litigation, public interest litigation, civil litigation across the country. Like they're claiming that they're not susceptible to lawsuit under 42 USC 1983. Most of your listeners, most of the people who watch this, will be really familiar with 1983 because it is the predominant lawsuit or the predominant statute that civil rights lawsuits are filed under, right? Like it is the violation of a right under color of law, right? That's what you could sue. So they're claiming they can't even be sued under it. They're also saying, they're not even saying that they don't enforce the law. They say they don't primarily. So because other people enforce it more than they do, then they shouldn't have to be, they're not susceptible to being enjoined, prohibited from enforcing it. So they never disclaim enforcement. They just say that we don't enforce it as much as somebody else. Then they say, oh, by the way, we're immune from all these lawsuits, which is an insane position to take. And then on top of all that, they go, and if you decide against us and the plaintiffs have standing, well, then we lose. Like, it is astounding.
It is astounding. So where is that particular case now? I mean, obviously the state of Texas has made their argument. Has FPC had the chance to reply?
So we filed a response brief to that last week,
Okay.
and it shows. I mean, I would encourage people to actually go to the website, firearmspolicy.org. The case is Ziegenfuss. I would encourage people to go and look at it and read it because it really does show just how crazy Texas's arguments are, but also just how disingenuous they are. It's so blatantly obvious that they are just trying to avoid getting a ruling against them because they're trotting out arguments that have been struck down by the Fifth Circuit 20 years ago. I mean, it is just blatantly ridiculous. But here's what's the problem, right? Texas has now made it to where there's a procedural question in the case. It's a silly one, and they're wrong, but now they've introduced this complication. So it puts us in a position where we have to go, okay, who else enforces this law? And so we told the court that we're looking towards other parties that also enforce this law concurrently, right? Not separately. They can each enforce it on their own. And that we're likely going to be moving the court to add those people. And so this might result in a bunch of additional defendants being added to this case, adding a bunch of burden to the court, adding a bunch more burden to, I mean, a bunch more taxpayers in Texas, just because the AG's office refused to just acknowledge that the law was unconstitutional and move forward with getting it struck down.
I was gonna say, I mean, so yeah, I mean, you guys could add, I guess, Dallas police, or right, maybe City of Arlington. But
Here's
if you
how
had only
crazy.
sued the Dallas Police Department over, let's say, Billy Bob, right? Well, DPS would have said, or not the DPS, but Dallas PD would have said, hey, listen, this is a state statute, right? So we're only enforcing state law. So they would have passed the buck on to DPS, right? They would have said, this is a law of statewide concern. This is something for the Attorney General's office to handle, right? It's this Kafka-esque exercise in finger pointing as to, who's responsible for enforcing these laws.
Yeah.
And ultimately, again, this is a law of statewide concern. Right. So you've got to challenge it, I would think, at the state level. You can't sue the legislature itself, right? And Texas DPS may not be the primary enforcer of these laws, but they are charged with enforcing those laws statewide, right?
Yeah, and also at any point in this, they could have disclaimed enforcement. They still haven't done that, right? We've gone through, they've now filed two briefs. They've never said, we agree that we will never enforce this law, right? They just say, oh, well, we don't primarily enforce it. But here's how ridiculous Texas's argument is. If you take it all the way to the logical conclusion, if you have to sue every person who could possibly enforce a law, right? Well, can you just sue DPS or do you have to sue a local DA? Okay, well, you sue a local DA. Do you have to sue the local law enforcement division? Do you have to sue all of the law enforcement divisions that have concurrent jurisdiction? Do you have to sue individual officers and sheriffs? Like, if DPS can't bind those below it, then who can bind down the chain on the other side? And so it's so patently ridiculous that I would never have anticipated the argument. Like I just didn't, I couldn't possibly see it coming from Texas. And when you look at like 1983, I mean I mean that one, not even California or New York is making that argument. Like nobody is arguing that you can't sue state officials for enforcement of state laws that violate constitutionally protected rights under 1983. That is quite literally why that statute was passed.
Amazing. It's interesting too because Ken Paxton, the Attorney General of Texas, has sued, for instance, the city of Dallas over the gun ban at the state fair. He's issued this advisory opinion. He's issued multiple advisory opinions during his time as Attorney General, weighing in on the validity of particular laws. So I am surprised that the Attorney General in his court filing says, yeah, these laws are unconstitutional. They lack an historic basis. But we don't have a formal opinion from the Attorney General's office stating that, right? I mean, we've got this court filing, but there's nothing stopping him from coming out and saying to the legislature, hey, you need to repeal these laws because they're unconstitutional.
Yeah, and we're not going to enforce them in the meantime because they
Yeah.
are unconstitutional. Nothing stops them.
That is again, it is a bizarre turn of events. So, now that your response brief has been filed, is this question now fully briefed before the court? Will it be up to a judge to decide whether or not the Attorney General's arguments have any merit?
So we have one more round of briefing.
Okay.
We've got a reply brief. And this case is also interesting because, so the way that the posture came out, when we initially filed, right, we were engaged in some settlement negotiations. Obviously, those didn't come to fruition. And so there were some stays and some delays in the case. And then Texas, when it filed its answer, right? So that's the first step, in response to a complaint. The defendant can either file an answer or a motion to dismiss if the complaint is, has legal problems. So they did not file a motion to dismiss. They filed an answer. And in their answer, they agreed with a lot of what we said, right? We said, hey, look, Texas has these laws that are unconstitutional and don't have a historical analog. And Texas is basically like, yeah, they don't have a historical analog. So they didn't raise any of their like jurisdictional problems or questions then. And then the court said, hey, look, I think that this is just legal questions. We should just move directly to a summary judgment briefing schedule. And everybody agreed. Yep, that sounds good. We'll just move directly to a summary judgment or just move directly to a merits briefing schedule. No problem. And the court also here has appointed amici to defend the merits of the law. So because Texas has suggested that the law is probably unconstitutional, the court's like, well, we need somebody to come in and defend the merits to ensure that it has a full-throated defense. And so the court has appointed amici to defend the merits of the law. So it's not even like the case is just would have just gone away sort of thing, right? Like the case is going to be moving forward. There are people who have been appointed to argue it. And so now we have that reply brief due, but then, like I said, we've told the court that we're taking a serious look at adding in additional defendants, given that Texas at this late phase of the game has decided to raise these jurisdictional questions and this concurrent jurisdiction problem. So there's going to be more happening now. It's certainly not going to just sit and rest and wait. Now it's going to be much more of a procedural kerfuffle.
Yeah. Well, I know that you stick to the legal stuff, but I will note that Ken Paxton is challenging John Cornyn for the U.S. Senate, and it has to be like Cornyn's got his own issues with the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. Sounds like this may be an issue for Ken Paxton in the Senate race there, and Texas gun owners and Second Amendment advocates should be paying attention to what's going on with these issues. And a great way to do that, again, is to follow the Firearms Policy Coalition. You guys are fantastic on social media. FPC.org is where, as you say, you can find all of these cases, including the latest filings on Ziegenfuss. Is that correct? Am I pronouncing that?
Yeah, yes,
Okay.
yeah, that's sometimes last names are last names.
Hey, absolutely. It's a listen, it's memorable. I will say that. This
Exactly.
isn't John Doe versus Joe Schmo. You should be able to remember Ziegenfuss. So, Cody, as always, man, I really appreciate you spending some time with us today. Thank you so much for everything you're doing over there at the FPC Action Foundation, and I look forward to having you back here again very soon.
Absolutely, sir. Thanks for having me on.
My thanks to Cody for joining us on the program, and looking forward to having him back again here before long. By the way, you might not hear the rooster today, but you may hear some pounding in the background. I'm having some roof work done. My Amish neighbor is over here with a couple of his crew working on that. So yeah, the rooster's been scared away. He's in the backyard, but you might still hear some background noise. All right, turning our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a disturbing story out of South Carolina. Fox News reporting the father of a North Carolina college student furious after a career criminal allegedly killed his daughter in a house burglary at the University of South Carolina. 22-year-old Logan Federico was visiting friends at USC in Columbia, staying at a house on Cypress Street on the evening of May 2nd. In the early morning hours of May 3rd, a man named Alexander Dickey, 30 years old, career criminal, allegedly entered the home, stole several credit and debit cards, and then fatally shot Logan Federico in what Columbia Police Chief Skip Holbrook described as a random crime during a press conference a couple of days later. Logan's father, Stephen Federico, told Fox News Digital, quote, "She was supposed to go down the night before. Plans got canceled. So she decided to do it on a Friday. That's the thing that's just gut-wrenching. She wasn't even supposed to be there. She was supposed to be home on Friday." It was a Saturday afternoon when Logan's mom, Melissa, was at home cooking. Two officers showed up at her door and told her that her daughter had been shot dead. Stephen Federico had been golfing with friends. His wife calls. She said, "I heard the screams from my wife on the phone. She didn't want to tell me that. I kind of had to pull it out of her. And she finally said, 'Logan's gone.' And I said, 'What do you mean gone?' And she said, 'Dead.' In that moment, I had no reaction. I was in shock. Having lost a child myself, I know exactly what that feels like. And I hate that Stephen and Melissa Federico had to experience that. I also hate the fact that the man who allegedly killed Logan Federico has nearly 40 prior arrests to his name across a variety of counties in North Carolina. Again, Alexander Dickey is just 30 years old. 40 criminal and traffic charges dating back to 2013. According to Fox News Digital, Dickey is accused of driving a stolen vehicle into that neighborhood, parking the car on Cypress Street, seemingly at random, according to police in Columbia. He then broke into one home, stole the keys to another vehicle, stole a gun, then broke into the home where Federico was staying. There, he allegedly stole several credit cards, saw Federico sleeping in one of the rooms, and then fatally shot her with that stolen gun. While she was sleeping, Again, this wasn't, like she woke up and she was getting ready to call police. I mean, this was not that that would have justified the shooting, mind you. But it just seems even more inexplicable. According to Columbia police, Dickey then went on a shopping spree using the stolen credit cards. And the stolen vehicle that he was using then broke down in Saluda County. He called a tow truck to have the stolen vehicle transported to a residence in Gaston, South Carolina. Authorities began tracking Dickey as a person of interest, then responded to that home in Gaston on May the 3rd. He allegedly fled the home when they arrived. They spent the remainder of Saturday, May the 3rd, looking for him. They found him around 4 o'clock in the afternoon on May the 4th after a resident in Gaston reported seeing a man later identified as Dickey emerge from the woods and steal a car, which then he proceeded to wreck a short time later. Yeah. According to Fox News Digital, Dickey is now charged with murder, two counts of first-degree burglary, two counts of possession of a weapon during the commission of a violent crime, possession of a weapon by a convicted felon, two counts of grand larceny of a motor vehicle, three counts of financial transaction theft, three counts of financial transaction card theft. Fox News Digital also reports that he had been given a probationary sentence for a burglary charge in 2023. That probation was actually reduced because he had complied with the terms of his probation briefly, I guess. Again, more than three dozen arrests over the past 12 years. And it sounds like, again, at least one felony conviction because he is charged with possession of a weapon by a convicted felon. It's not known if that is the only felony conviction that he faced or whether or not he ever spent any time in prison for any felony convictions. But I understand the fury that Stephen Federico feels learning not only that his daughter was senselessly murdered, but that the man allegedly responsible could have and should have been behind bars at the time. Now, on to today's Armed Citizen story from Aurora, Colorado, where police say charges are not expected after a homeowner shot a intruder. This was earlier in the week. I think this was on Monday. CBS in Denver reports that a day after an Aurora man shot a suspected intruder in their garage, detectives don't expect any charges to be filed, although they will be presenting their case to the local DA's office. It was just before 5 o'clock on Monday, where police said that the homeowner shot and injured the suspect there in the garage. The homeowner had reported a similar break-in just a couple of days earlier, May 17th, when about $400 worth of items had been taken. After that incident, the homeowner told police that he had bought and installed cameras in his garage, which alerted him to the presence of a stranger there in the garage on Monday. Homeowner told police that when he went to the garage and confronted the suspect, there was an altercation that ended when the homeowner shot the suspected intruder. Suspect remained in the hospital as of Monday night with life-threatening injuries. But again, the homeowner not expected to face any charges in that incident. And finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Layton, Utah, who helped a driver after the car hit some power poles. Sheldon Williams was out and about on Monday afternoon. He was getting ready to get his son a shake at a local fast food joint when he and his son Adam heard a huge boom. Sheldon Williams telling KSL TV it sounded like a bomb went off. It was just a huge explosion. He thinks it was a transformer. There was a driver who had been heading westbound, I guess, on a road that then slammed through three power poles, three of them, and ended up flipping his vehicle. Sheldon Williams said that dust had flown everywhere, and he ran over to see if he could help. At that point, the car was on fire. He could tell that the man inside was badly injured. He said, "I was just so scared for the guy. He was shaking." And he said, "The car was on fire, by the way. The car was actually on fire. I could see the smoke." He was able to cut the man's seatbelt and get him onto the ground before emergency crews arrived. Police are still investigating the cause of the crash. As of Monday night, no word on the man's condition. The incident left about 2,000 people without power for a brief period of time. But Sheldon Williams in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to at least give this individual a fighting chance at survival by removing him from that burning vehicle, and the presence of mind, and again, the ability to extricate that stranger from a very precarious and life-threatening situation. So again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Hopefully his son Adam got that shake from Jack in the Box. Sheldon Williams, we appreciate your very good deed. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. And I do want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Again, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We are going to keep you up to date on what's going on with the House Rules Committee markup of the budget reconciliation bill. What, if any, language regarding suppressors, short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns will be included in that reconciliation bill? Remains to be seen as of mid-morning anyway, but hopefully we'll have some answers for you this afternoon. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.